very successful trip to Africa. A lot of practical things were accomplished on this trip. It was not just where we went to look at things and kind of hope to plan, but a lot of very practical physical things were accomplished along with the spiritual mission of the trip, which I believe is one and the same. I feel that God has called us to do certain things in caring for one another, and that the physical and spiritual and mental and emotional all blend together. We visited most of the churches in the southern part of Africa, and that included our group in Lusaka, Zambia, in Mumbwa, where we have 70 to 90 people, but what was gathered on that Sunday was 48 people from two villages. Also, we have a family that lives in Kitwe on the Belgian-Congo border, or in Zaire border. That's the Derek Pringles. Then in Malawi, where we had all kinds of new people came who now have become part of a group. Then we also met what we thought would be the most dangerous place of all, Harare in Zimbabwe, which turned out to be the safest and one of the most enjoyable kind of relief areas. And I'll tell you about that. And then also the group there was 14. And then in Johannesburg, South Africa, we met with a group of 35 on a Sunday night Bible study. That was last Sunday night. One thing that the brethren all had to say was, please give greetings to our brethren in the United States. That came spontaneously from them over and over again and said they appreciate being remembered also by others wherever they are in the world. So every single one of these groups, whether it was in Mumbwa, the brethren there, or in Lusaka, they said, please give greetings to the people in Lafayette and Terre Haute. They had even looked it up. They saw where I came from. They had these things down. I mean, I was amazed as to their knowledge of really what's happening over here as far as geography, as far as where we're from, and also you know, who we are, and you know, what our roles are in the church. When I came there, I had been greeted very warmly, and people knew the types of things that I was doing in different places. And the one big question that everybody asked was, how are the Ukrainians? the people in this remote area of Mumbwa asked me about how are the Ukrainians. Could you tell us about the Ukrainians? I said, I'm tired about talking to the Ukrainians. I want to talk about the Africans. Anyway, this was very, very interesting to me. They had some of the most astute questions about the work, about the church, about the Bible. I was amazed as to how spontaneous they were in meetings. And this was, in a way, one of the blessings of being with the Africans, is there's a certain spontaneity and openness about them that is extremely refreshing. One of the things I did, I was in denial with when I first went down to Africa, was the fact that it's the dead of winter. July 1st is the same as January 1st for us. And I was asking questions to Andres, you know, do you need to bring shorts? And, well, I knew that it was, you know, our seasons were opposite. I didn't realize it was real winter down there. And the problem is compounded by the fact that people don't heat their homes. People just don't heat where they're at. In fact, I understood why they need blankets down there. And that's one thing in Malawi. People just don't heat, period. But when I arrived in Johannesburg, sunset was at 5:15 in the afternoon. There was frost in the morning. It was just plain winter. Short days, homes are not heated. Where I stayed at the campuses, they had a little space heater for me in the bedroom, and that became the favorite place for the cats. They all came up to the space heater and both leaned against on it, one on one side and one on the other, and then in the middle of the night they crawled up and slept with me, so I just got to, all friendly with cats. Well, the passage that really struck me, and in fact moved me very much, is that oftentimes people don't regard areas like this as being important. And Africa is far away, the problems are far away, and the problems are extremely comprehensive and deep. The life expectancy in Malawi is 36, in Zimbabwe it's 40, and it's planned to, with the present trend in AIDS and other diseases, it's planned to go down even further. And sometimes people have written these areas off in their mind as something that I don't want to deal with these problems, or else in the church we have an attitude of we'll take care of it in the wonderful world tomorrow when Jesus Christ comes back, and our responsibility to these areas is zero. I want to say that we have a responsibility to these areas, especially where we have brethren and where they are suffering and going through difficult times. I feel that we have an injunction in the book of Galatians that we're to do good unto all men, especially to those of the household of God. And when we take a look at the example of the Apostle Paul, who roved throughout the Roman Empire, where there were churches that were rich, churches where there was security, such as Corinth, which was a commercial center, things were happening there. He was ready to give aid to people in Philippi, in Jerusalem when they had a famine, and other places. And we need to be attuned to and be very attentive to the fact that we have people who are going through extremely difficult conditions, living through extremely difficult conditions. In Acts chapter 17, verse 26, God has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth. This is Acts 17 and verse 26. And has determined their preappointed times in the boundary of their dwellings. God is the one who spread out the human race from one man, Adam, and determined the bounds. We're all brothers. We're all made of the same blood. And one thing you find is when you visit with these people, and if you get personal with them and talk to them about their children, about their families, about their marriages, talk about their life, they are no different and have the same needs that you and I have. When they grieve as much as you grieve, they get as jealous as you and I get jealous, they get as happy and rejoicing as much as you and I are, they are the same. They are not non-people. And I feel like it's important for us to realize this. In Romans, of course, the passage that strikes me is that there's no respect of persons with God. Romans chapter 2 and verse 11. God has the same regard for human beings, whether they are the brethren in Mumbwa, where last year some of their children saw an electric light for the very first time. They brought a generator to the feast so they could watch a festival video, and some of the children in that community saw an electric light bulb for the first time. And that was so exciting to them to see this light bulb light up. They don't have a generator now. They have a tape player on which they listen to Sabbath services. But they don't have enough for batteries. And so they have devised a car battery that has a solar-powered trickle charger. And by that means, they're able to listen to tapes from around the world on the Sabbath. I feel that we have a responsibility to help people, and there is a way in which we can all make a difference. I think the church is coming around to the point where it's incumbent upon us to share some of the burden and to care about people in areas where I feel like we can make a difference, and we can make a difference in their lives. We have people who live on incomes as low as $17 a month in Zambia. We have people who have had major disasters in their lives, like losing all their cattle. That's basically losing your wealth. That's losing your frame of income bearing. And right now, our families in the Mumbwa area have women and children. Have their wife and children pull a plow while the man is behind the plow digging up and preparing the soil. They wish they could have their cattle, but a disease called corridor disease spread by the wild African buffalo, spreading with ticks when the cattle graze in community pastures, spread this disease very rapidly, and 98% of the cattle in that region died. And so the people lost their draft power, their power to plow the soil. And so now they're in subsistence stage where they just grow just enough, and that's all they can grow, to supply the food for their family. But if they were to get animals, they could plow four times as much or five times as much and be able to sell some of the grain in the major city of Lusaka and improve the standard of living. And I'll tell you a little bit about what we did to expedite that process. We can help people through microloans, which is a very simple program where we can lend up to $100, $200, maybe up to $500 to help people get established and have them have some type of income-producing function based upon that loan where they can pay the loan back. Malawi is the third poorest country in the world. Only two poorer countries in Malawi. One is Mozambique, which is next to Malawi, and the poorest country in the world is Lesotho, which is completely surrounded by South Africa. Lesotho is known for its only export, which is sand. and that is the only export the country has, sand. I was absolutely shocked when I saw at the clinic in the Longue, the pictures that we had of the clinic show it to be kind of an older building, but maybe there's something inside. When I came in there, I did not recognize it at all from the photos. It was an old movie theater before, and the reception room is basically where the main part of the theater was. Now, it's very small. It's a very small theater. But three-quarters of the clinic is the reception room, and they have benches around the table, and mothers with their babies sit around them. And there's a sign there behind them that is a sign in the Chewa language, which says, "Four children are enough, even if they are all girls." And then this is a sign there for, because people have children until they hit their boy in the family. But it shows a happy picture of a family with four girls running around. It says, "Four children are enough, even if they are all girls." This is to encourage them to maintain their families at no more than four. In the back of the clinic are the two rooms. One is called a consultation room, and one is called the treatment room. In the consultation room, Mr. Chandi sits there with the patients that come through, and I followed one of the patients all the way through. And they first of all come into the reception area, which is this disproportionate huge room, and they pay their fee, and $2 for an adult and $1 for a child, if they can pay that much. But of course, with the little income they have, many people do not pay the Chandis when they come to the clinic. The clinic has absolutely no support from anybody. They have to make it on their own. And what shocked me was is that almost everything in the clinic was things that we had put on the container. The wheelchair, that was ours. The desks, we had very nice desks that were donated by a member in Wisconsin. They were there. All the other items, they said everything almost is there. The needles, the syringes, everything was things that we had sent over there. In the treatment room, Mrs. Chandi, who's a nurse, had a big pan of needles, and she was boiling this huge pot of water to sterilize these needles. And I said, "You don't really use the reusable needles over again, do you? The non-reusable needles over again." She says, "Well, we try not to." So this is the kind of conditions that they have to live in. We have very little supplies, and they said that we had shipped them hundreds of pounds of powdered milk. That was one of the very popular things. And they said they still have people now, after they've run out 6 months ago, that just come there and beg them, and they say, "Is there any more powdered milk coming? When is it coming?" One of the women that came in, she was a mother that was no more than 16 or 17 years old, and she had the baby strapped on her back, and there was a tummy that was extended out, and the ankles were all swollen. And she came to Mrs. Chandi, who basically says the problem is malnourishment. They just eat this maize that's all refined. They have nothing else besides that, and they're just malnourished. So she writes a little slip out for her, says malnutrition. And then she's passing this out to one and passing out to another. That's basically the diagnosis. They come in there, their babies are sick, their babies are deformed because of this malnutrition condition. And the mother just takes the baby, straps it on her, and just walks out. You have no idea what she's going to do with it, how she's going to better her condition, what is going to be happening later. Life and death in these areas. You see children everywhere. Mothers strapped with one child on one side, sometimes a child strapped in the front, and carrying perhaps a 5-gallon jug of water on her head. And you see this over and over again. Or carrying sticks for making a fire, or carrying charcoal, or just anything on their heads. I'm amazed as to all the things that they carry. Lots of new life and lots of death. Mr. Chandi's nephew just last week died of AIDS. He talked about his secretary that had been at the clinic for a number of years. She died of AIDS just 8 months ago, and the secretary they have now is a brand new one. This woman who died of AIDS, her husband had died of AIDS 4 months before, and now both of their children have died. Of course, this brings the average age of the population way down, but many children, many people die. They're used to this. It's just part of the life and death process of having people around them die, and at the same time, a very high birth rate. And just being there in the middle of it all just kind of really struck me. I had heard about these, you hear the statistics, but you come to the Chande's home, you sit there, and we talk about this neighbor who dies, that one who dies, the witch doctor that lives down the street here, another person who's sort of an anti-witch doctor called Sam Gomez, because some people feel that the diseases they have are curses put on them. Then they have these Sam Gomez who reverse the curse for a fee. And they have all kinds of remedies for AIDS. And people have become so desperate and so hopeless because of AIDS, because once a person's HIV positive, they realize that they're just a walking time bomb, that before long they will have AIDS and they will die from AIDS. So there's been a lot of folklore and a lot of folk remedies that have been diabolical introduced, such as if you have sex with a virgin, that'll cure you of AIDS. So that people, you know, think, well, this will cure it. And so there has been a lot of immorality and a lot of just desperate activity to try to stem the problems they have. The violence, the lack of security. The Chande's home, for example, and this is not the way all homes are, have not only a fence around it, but a wall with glass bottles or have some kind of spikes in them for people coming in. Otherwise, you will be robbed. The day we came to the clinic, somebody stole the fuse box in the clinic, so we had no lights when we were there. So they operated now. They said they've been operating several days without any type of electricity. The phone was installed there finally after 3 years. They had to keep paying for it every month because they didn't want to lose their position in line. Worked for about 2 months, and now it no longer works, and they have no idea when it'll be fixed. The clinic has louvered windows in the front, but the iron grating for protecting people from breaking in was on the inside, and all but two of the louvers were stolen. They were just all pulled off. And so as a mother is coming in with her child to sit at the clinic, there's this winter wind that's blowing in there. It's just this cold, raw wind that is continually there. There's no heat. And I got cold. And here, these people walking around, working out exposed to the elements all the time. But the clinic has no heat, never has. It has virtually no windows. And they put curtains up, and people have been trying to steal those through the bars on the inside. And so in the design of the new clinic, they will have iron bars that will be on the outside. One sign that you see a lot of are coffin makers. You see these places, little carpenter shops. It looks like one of the biggest things under construction are, they call them coffins, or caskets, but they call them coffins there. I arrived in Johannesburg, this was 2 weeks ago, last Thursday, on a long flight from New York. It was a 14-and-a-half-hour flight, one of the longest there is. And I sat next to a captain of a 707 working for a Belgian freight firm. He lives in Miami. He goes to Africa every other month, flies for a month, and he flies for the Red Cross. He flies for the different governments, and they deliver different things, and he comes home. And he basically said that Africa has just got to be a place of hopelessness. If you want anything delivered, you have to deliver it by air, because so many things just never get there and disappear. When I arrived, Andre Van Belkom picked me up. Johannesburg really is an impressive city. It's like any big city. And it's like an island of wealth in the midst of so much of the poverty of Africa. I stayed at the home of the campuses. He is a deacon and the leading member, one of the leading members of the Johannesburg Church, which does not have an elder at the present time. But he takes care of that church when Andre Van Belkom is not there, which is 4 to 5 weeks at a time. We stayed there, and then the next day, Andre and I flew up to Lusaka, Zambia. Zambia is also one of the poorest countries in the world. It's maybe a notch or two higher than Malawi, but also very, very poor. I brought the computer that was donated by one of our people in the Terre Haute congregation, and I had it all fixed up, and as we were going through customs, through the nothing to declare section, we got stopped. They were curious about what's in this box, so we had to go and spend Andre about 20 minutes in talking about how this was for humanitarian purposes, how we wanted to help people, and we still had to pay $40 duty to bring that computer in. But we had tried so hard to get that thing working, which we did, and bring it all that distance, and then have this $40 fee that we paid to probably somebody who pocketed much of it because he didn't really get a proper receipt back for it. We were met by the elder, Mr. Kamani Banda, of the Lusaka Church, a person who works for Kariba Minerals as the head accountant. He's quite well-to-do by their standards, and just a person who took us around and spent a lot of time with us. Kariba Minerals is a company there which processes amethyst. And there are two places where amethyst is mined in the world. One is right there in Zambia, not too far from Lusaka, and the other place is Brazil. And so they have people who break the amethyst down, and then they get it ready to ship to India and to Hong Kong, where it's made into jewelry. But almost 100% of the market for this particular type of amethyst is right there from the building that we were in. We got the computer up and working. Happy seconds, happy moment. Then we went over to the Lusaka office of Heifer Project International because we wanted to talk to them about the plight of our brethren. Again, they had lost all their cattle, and we talked to the director, the country director of Heifer Project International. He explained a little bit more about the program, and there have been so many things that have worked just real well. Heifer Project has already given away 4 million calves around the world, 4 million heifers. It's a program that is privately funded, has a few government grants, which believes that the basis of wealth in a nation is the establishment of their cattle and herds. And they have been rebuilding herds in needy areas in 5 different zones of the world, and Africa is one of them. And just about 3 or 4 years ago, they opened up this office in Zambia. The director was an interesting gentleman. He was a Malawian refugee who escaped during political turmoil in Malawi, which is the country right next to Zambia. But he spent 7 years in Russia, in the Soviet Union, and he worked as a veterinary scientist. He was from the Chuwa tribe, Malawian, living in Zambia, who spoke perfect Russian. I mean, this is just a very interesting combination. He was very sympathetic to our cause. We explained what we had. That we had need for cattle, and they have a program that to me is a World Tomorrow special type of program in how to rebuild, how to build, how to maintain, and how to take care of the environment. They have a 12 cornerstone program for giving away cattle, as far as providing cattle, I should say. And much of the process involves education. They come to assess the need. They spend 8 months in educating the people about the care of cattle so that some of the diseases that they've had before won't be repeated. They train them with a veterinary kit where they have these different types of medications that they give the cattle. They want things to be done their way. They're very particular about that. And one of the things that was mentioned there is that the people in these communities community graze their cattle. So they all get together and they put all their cattle into one big field. But that spreads disease. It spreads this tick from the wild buffalo, and that's what's caused the death of all these animals. And so Heifer Project does not allow their cattle to be community grazed. It makes sure that the cattle is not given to a community, but given to an individual in the community who will care for it, be responsible for it, and then the first born, or the first offspring, of that heifer must go to a qualified neighbor, somebody in the community. So as they try to improve their economic state, part of the process is to increase the economic state of the entire community. It's not just something for yourself or where you become an island of people who have special privileges and everybody else around you looks at you. You try to go out to the community. And this has been an extremely effective program. And we want to be able to restore about 24 head of cattle to our brethren, who have now zero. In fact, when we were there, we saw a team of oxen come in. We said, "What's this?" You know, and they said, "Oh, we rented these." They rented them for plowing because they were tired of having the wife and the kids pull the plow, and so they rented this pair of oxen for plowing. On the Sabbath, this was 2 weeks ago, Sabbath, we had services in Lusaka, where Mr. Banda and another member with his family itself. I think that it was a home that was probably owned by the college. It had all kinds of interesting trees. He showed us around, and we had Sabbath services there, and then he and his wife were celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary in a couple of days, where they had 90 people come, all their friends, to the home. But we weren't there that day, so we took them out to dinner 2 weeks ago, Saturday night. The next morning, Sunday, was one of the big days. This is the drive out to Mumbwa, about 100 miles to the east. You go about 60, 70 miles on a main road, which is the main highway, straight as could be, although it's all beat up, that goes towards Angola. And then you get off about 30, 35 miles onto secondary roads. And believe me, they're very secondary. It took far longer on that secondary road than it did on the main road. But as we left Lusaka, they said, well, we need to have some coolant. We need to buy some coolant. And Mr. Banda's boss had given him to use that day a Land Rover, so we wouldn't have to have a small car. And in fact, I don't know how in the world he gets through with a small car, but he goes out there once a month to preach and to take care of the brethren. We had a Land Rover. Well, we got out of town, just leaving town when we see that, we stopped the car and it wouldn't start again. Battery had run down. Well, what's the problem? The broken belt, and we had to fix that. So we got coolant. We went back to his Kariba mineral place because it's a safe place to work on something. You just don't work on things in the open because you could get robbed very easily. We were told to sit tight. People's homes have huge fences and spikes and everything because of the violence. In fact, people don't, at night, stop at red lights. Because if you stop at a red light, you're a sitting duck because bandits are around and they just attack people and cars, etc. So we went back to his place of business where he could open up the hood and replace the belt and headed out of town. We got out of town a little bit and all of a sudden this is the first thing that happened. We're going about 50, 55 miles an hour on this road. And all of a sudden, the hood flies up on this Land Rover, cracks the windshield in two places. The hood is mangled into about 800 different shapes in front of us, and so we have a problem. Well, Webster, our driver, we had a driver come along with us, runs into this little settlement, comes up 10, 15 minutes later with some wire. And so we wire the hood down. I wired it all over the front. We couldn't take it off. We had no place to put it. It was just huge. So we started driving, and then all of a sudden, the engine overheats. Overheated. So to get to the radiator, we had to take all the wire off and lift up the hood again. And the driver, for some reason, just quickly opened that. You know, this thing sprays all over the place. And so we sit there for 20 minutes, half an hour, waiting for it to cool down. So we put in a little bit of coolant, which we had bought that day, but I didn't know what was really in there. We go another 5 miles, it overheats again. Again, we had to take all the wire off and to get underneath. That happened 3 times. So we sent back the driver on a big truck coming the other way back into town to get his car. To get Mr. Bonds' car and catch up with us, because we really wanted to get out to see the people. I didn't want to turn back. And so he got on this big, cargo, 18-wheeler, and vanished. We never saw him again. We did, though, went to Villa, and this is a desert-like area, needed some water, because we wanted to see what we could fill up. And we got some water and filled the radiator up and just hoping that it wasn't a leak, that we could go. Then all of a sudden, this man in blue shows up on the road. Just because there's people walking around all over the place. This man in blue, we call him our blue angel. He comes in and he seems to know about
the insides of a Land Rover. He gets in there with a hammer and something else. He did another loose belt here and everything. I mean, there were just all kinds of things were wrong. He loosened up the belts, was happy with that. We wired the hood back down and start heading out towards Mumbwa. And never had overheating problems that day. But our driver, Webster, still, you know, I had to ride back there and see if Webster ever made it. We got to Mumbwa 3.5 hours late. It took us 6.5 hours to go 110 miles or so. And the children were waiting. They had children as sentries on this road. And as soon as they saw our Land Rover, they shouted to the other kids, and then they all ran back to the village, and, you know, they're here, you know, this is a big event. And we drive in there. But the road from the main road, there were places where it was like a crater. And you come there, and you figure out, how am I going to get through this? Do you go around? Do you go through it? Or just what? So we sit there, make a decision, and then, you know, it was the most unbelievably bad road that I had ever seen. Then you'd end up in a settlement of some sort. The road ends. Where does it start up? Oh, the other side of the settlement. All of a sudden the road starts up again, but you're going through chickens and people and everything. You're getting, you go through there and you continue on. At places there was a split in the road. There are no signs. No signs at all, period. And the driver looks, which way do we go, right or left? I don't know. I'm not from Zambia. But we finally out there. There are some places in Mozambique where they have intentional potholes, where people sit by a pothole, and as you come by, you can't cross it, they say they'll fill it up for you for a fee. And so they fill it up, you pass through it, you pay them, you pass through it, then they go dig it out again and wait for the next driver to come by. The top of the Land Rover was open. There were several times we busted our head against the top of the Land Rover, and we come into town, I thought, oh, I better comb my hair, but it was hopeless. It was like a Brillo pad, you know, it was just absolutely just unmanageable, and if you ever heard of Ring Around the Collar in its ultimate, my shirt was so black, you know, from the dirt, and then we come into the village, and there's no chance at all. The door's open. People surround us. They're so happy to see us. They're wearing suits, ties, and everything, and we are as grungy as, you know, as could be after 6.5 hours in that Land Rover. They were so happy to see us.
But then a leader of this group said, my house burnt down 2 days ago. And his round home literally did. It burned. It caught fire with an oil lamp on a Friday night that had tipped over, and it burnt his house down. He lost all his possessions. He just was able to throw out the church boombox for listening to sermons outside, and that was able to be saved. But otherwise, almost everything was destroyed. We had to find some way to help him. We figured the total cost of all his possessions probably about $500 to $800 or so, but try to help him out in some way. We came there and they thought, well, we'll have dinner first, and then we'll have our service. And they had one of the, like a hut, but it was like a communal kitchen, and they had pots of different things. They had sudsa, which is this maize, it's the ground up corn that was cooking. Then they had an antelope that they killed just the day before, because we were coming. They had antelope, they had like chicken wings, and they had that was about it, you know, but it was just very, very nice. And so Mr. Van Belkom had told them that they really wanted the women to eat with us this time, because their custom is when you have guests, the men start to gather, the women are nowhere to be seen, that they really wanted the women together. Well, they did the next best thing. The women were on the other side of the building, at least from up to where we could see them, but we men were all together. They had built a church hall, would you believe, in this community. It was, you know, it had a podium, it had an area for people to sit, and that's one of the first things that they did. In all the homes, everybody who lives in the settlement is part of the United Church of God. And so everybody comes together, that's kind of their community meeting hall. They built it in 3 days. You know, it's built from, you know, the different tropical trees, grass, thatch, and so forth. So that's where we had the dinner. And so they brought the food to us. Of course, all the utensils had got burned up in the fire a couple of days before that. But they finally managed to find two spoons, one for me and one for Andre Van Belkom. They don't eat with spoons. They just kind of grab things. So they brought the salsa to us, and I just kind of peel it off. It's like, you know, cream of wheat, you know, just kind of that consistency. And you kind of, you know, kind of hardened cream of wheat. You take chunks off on your plate. And then they said, oh, would you like antelope? Yeah? I said, we have three choices here. We have antelope, and we have chicken, and we have intestines. And so I said, well, antelope, chicken sound kind of good, you know, but the intestines, we passed that. It means liver and different things like that. You know, I thought I was going to have some kind of, you know. But anyway, so that, they put the subs around, they pour the gravy on top of it, and I had this big serving spoon, you know, that we ate from. But the rest of them, once we were served, kind of grabbing for the salsa, you know. They were immaculately dressed. I mean, out there. They wore suits and ties. And we're the ones that looked terrible, you know, just after this 6.5-hour trip through the bush. And so they had question after question for us. It was a wonderful meal. And then it was time for the service. And the women were all ushered in, and everybody sat there. We had 48 people for the service. And Andre Van Belkom spoke first, and then I got up there, and they gave me a real nice clock with a Zambia insignia on it. And then in the first row, so here's all these women breastfeeding their kids. You know, just, I hear, chow, 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 you know? And, you know, I just wasn't, you know, used to that. And I thought, when I told Deb about this, she said, well, that'll cure you of having any distractions from children. Very true. You know, just actually kind of a nice community type of a, you know, thing. So the service went for about 2 hours. Then they showed us, I wanted to see their fields. And they showed us, well, they had just harvested maize. That's actually harvest time. And their cash crop is cotton, which they haven't harvested yet. But Mr. Banda has been very, very good with these people in that he has a truck at work where he can come out there and pick up their maize. Now, if they sell their maize to a middleman, they get about $4 for a 90-pound sack. That's what they sell it to, a middleman who takes it into Lusaka to sell. But Mr. Banda is able to pick all these sacks up, store them at his home. He actually has a farm outside of town. And he's able to wait for the price to get right, and then he's able to sell it, and he's been able to sell it for 50 to 55,000 kwachas, which is four times more than what they have. So he's been very helpful in that way. Then they showed us some of the transportation modes that they had. Bicycle is the way that they travel. And they had seven bicycles, like a parking lot there, where they had all come into services. And one of the families, I said, show me how you come to services. And so on a bicycle, he was the rider. He had one child in front of him, two children in front of him, one on the handlebars, one kind of in his lap, and his wife behind him. This is on a bicycle. And they came over from the village about 7 or 8 miles, maybe 10 miles, to services. And that's the way that they go back and forth. And we saw their bicycles there in terrible state of disrepair. And we hope to be able to, for each family, be able to have a bicycle given to them. That's one way I feel like we can really, really help these people get around. Because many of them walk. Some of them walk the 7 or 8 miles to services, while those that were, you know, blessed had this bicycle that they came on. But the bicycles have to be made there. You know, they're special durability and they look a special way. And they were they cost $100 a piece. So we hope to be able to have a project with people donating to have bicycles. We thought to make it fair, we'd give every family one bicycle for transportation. Then they can use the old ones they have, which really are in a bad state of disrepair, as kind of spares or for the children or as kind of the second car. But basically, that is a very, very important mode of transportation. Zambia has 73 languages. And the language that's spoken out by the people in Mumba is Ilo language, it's called. In fact, some of my sermon was translated in Ilo. Mr. Banda is a Chewa, and that's another group of languages. But there are a total of 73 different languages and 6 major language groups. We came back then that night from Mumba. We wanted to get home before dark. Of course, that was our plan at the beginning, because they're so fearful of bandits, of people holding you up. Hijacks are just very, very common. But we really couldn't, because we came there so late. And we left almost at sunset. We left at 10 after 5, and sunset was about 5:20 or so, and we headed back. On the main highway coming back, we were stopped at least 7 times by the police. They have roadblocks, AK-47s, you're in total darkness, but all of a sudden there's a big flashing light that goes out when they see a car coming, and you have to stop. And they look inside of your vehicle to see if you have any maize, because they know people bring maize into the city to be sold, and they put an immediate tax on it that you pay on the spot. Of course, we didn't have any maize, but we were stopped 7 times, and the policemen look in the back of your vehicle to see if you have any maize to bring into town. We got home about 10 o'clock at night, and as we came into Lusaka, our driver at this time was Kamani Banda, did not stop at any red lights. He says, you stop at a red light at night, you are a sitting duck, because a lot of bandits just wait for people at red lights, and that's when they shoot them or rob them or take them into the bush. And it's a nation and the whole area that we were in where people have this survival instinct like a cat, you know, just always looking to see, you know, if anybody is going to get you. From there, we went from Lusaka the next day. We flew up to Kitwe, right on the border of Zaire, where one of our members, Derek Pringle, and his wife, Cherry, lives. He's a refugee from Zimbabwe. He fought in Ian Smith's army in the Civil War for many, many years. And he had, of course, many stories to tell, but he's the one who helps mail out the good news for both Zambia and Malawi. And the number of people receiving the good news has really been growing at a very, very good rate. So he and his wife take care of that. We brought them a computer as well, one brought from the home office. In fact, they're connected with email, except that where they live in their home, they can only use a cell phone, because every time they try to connect a regular phone outside their wall, people keep stealing the copper wires all the time. So the phone works for a few days, but then they look outside, and the wire's all stolen. So they can only work with a cell phone and have to use a computer at where he works. So we spent a day up there, then went back to Lusaka and on to Malawi. That was going to be, I was so excited about going to Malawi because of the Chandes and all the things that we had done there. We got there and a whole van full of people met us. Dr. Chilapora, who now has become part of United, he's a person who's been out of the church for a while, to the south. He's a 72-year-old doctor, and he and his wife, Grace, came, Chande's 3 sons, and Mr. Chande. And they got us, and we were so happy to see each other. I mean, it was just so exciting. Went back to Chande's home, where she had a real nice meal fixed for us, and we just talked all that afternoon. I went to the clinic to see it. It was just a few hundred feet away, and that's when I was just aghast as to what I saw, as to just how poor and how little there was. And when they say, could you please send us anything? Sometimes we say, well, what do we send? You know, do they really need this? They need everything that we could possibly send them, literally anything. It is so bad as far as just the availability of the very simplest things. I brought over a blood pressure device, a sphygmomanometer, and a stethoscope. Would you believe a clinic did not have those things? I mean, those are just normal types of items that you would expect. And she was ecstatic. These were from Joanne Chappard, who was a nurse in the Terre Haute Church. So they were very happy. Also with the computer, I brought over Tony Pacelli. He gave me a huge number of floppy disks. I thought, what are we going to do with these things? They're ancient, you know. Well, they were just very happy to get them when I gave the computer to Mr. Banda. There, we also had a few other people that came to Chandi's home, a fellow by the name of Cephas. And he talked to Andre Van Belkin for a long time, very interested in the church, and a nephew of Chandi's called Diverson. We talked to him, and we baptized him in Lake Malawi, which is about 50, 60 miles to the east. Our Day of Independence, of course, is July 4th, and they said, "You remember this is July 4th? I said, "Oh, yeah, that's right, in the U.S., fireworks, yes." And then the next day was July 5th, and that's the day that we dedicated, had a kind of a groundbreaking ceremony for the clinic. They bought a very, very nice little plot of land for the clinic. He has all of the deed for it and so forth. I was amazed. I was sitting at the Chandi's home, and all of a sudden, this one man comes into the house. He just kind of walks in. He looks really sharp and all that, and this is Chandi's brother, Sam Banda. And we got to talking and find out that he's a member of parliament. He's a member of the Malawi parliament. He had been. He says, "However, I'm in the opposition party," he says. And that says, it doesn't sound as good as really, you know, being a member of parliament, because he's been in prison seven different times. Whenever the government really wants to crack down or they don't like dissension, they just put a lot of members of parliament in prison. And they sit there for 2-3 weeks until they, you know, they're still thinking, straightens out or whatever. But he was a very interesting person to talk to. He was very much excited about the clinic. And frankly, the types of things that this new clinic will offer, it will really be a very exciting, beautiful asset to that community. And he said that he will arrange for the Minister of Health to be there or be helpful in that process, with the Minister of Health coming out to be part of the dedication, which we hope to have sometime next year when the clinic is finished. That was really a high point as well, is to be with the Chandis. I just thoroughly enjoy their spirit. They're very humble people. They're very communicative, very sharing. One thing I found too, which was very exciting too, not only in Zambia but also in Malawi, that those people get along real well with each other, exceptionally so. They share things. They talk about things. They're not jealous about us giving help to one person, but they kind of talk about it and even share things. And that was just very, very good, because I was telling Mr. Chandi, "Well, what about Mr. Chilapora? You know, he has a clinic and he's a doctor. You know, so there's some things that he wants." "Oh," he says, "well, we've already shared things from the first containers. I couldn't possibly keep everything here, and so we have shared things." And it was just wonderful to see that type of spirit of not wanting to hoard or to keep all for yourself, but to kind of work with others. And some of the other items that we had shipped 3 tons of, on that container, the 23 container, 3 tons of dried soup mix. Well, that's a lot, even for Malawi. And they had shared a lot of that with the orphanage in town that they were going to take us to, but the car broke down and was going to take us there, and we weren't able to get there. From Malawi, we flew down to Harare in Zimbabwe. Of course, all the horror stories about all the beatings and the people being driven off of farms and the conditions in Harare. You know, people say, "Oh, stay out of there. Don't go there. It's a very dangerous place." Well, we found it to be almost the most pleasant place on our entire trip. The city of Harare, I have been there before with Beth when we were there for the feast in 1996, but it was so much more than Lilongwe or Lusaka. It had curbs, it had paving, it had no potholes, even though they say the things are getting worse all the time. But really, it was just like being going on vacation, coming out of the real destitute world to a place that really was much, much better off. And so we stayed at the home of one of the ladies and her husband, who was not in the church. Her name is Jill Heathcote and Roy Heathcote, and it was just very enjoyable. Again, though, it was cold the whole time. You know, it was, of course, the further south we go, now it's getting colder. In fact, everything is backwards from what it is here. They said, "Oh, we're so glad that the days are getting longer now." And of course, for us, the days are getting shorter. And we're looking forward to spring and all that type of thing. So we had a service on the Sabbath. We had 14 people in attendance, a lot of people that we had met from before. And then on Sunday morning, we flew down to Johannesburg. I was amazed at the amount of traffic into Harare. There was jumbo jet after jumbo jet was full of people coming up to hunt, people coming up to visit, mostly people from South Africa coming up to Harare. We flew down Sunday afternoon and then were whisked off to a Bible study in Johannesburg. And most of the meetings that we had went two and a half hours. People were just so happy to talk and want to ask questions and said, keep talking, tell us what's going on. There are people who are starved for communications with the rest of the world. But coming back, I'm more resolved than ever to be an agent of trying to help people who really are in need in these very, very difficult parts of the world, in particular Zambia and Malawi. In Zambia, I'd like to work with Heifer Project, which is very sympathetic to getting the herds built back up because that is their economic base. If we can help them with this, I feel like we have done a great service. Help them with bicycles, giving them their transportation. For a little over $1,000, we can provide basically the major transportation that they need when they go from village to village, you know, going 5, 7, 10, 15 miles, because that is their way of getting around. Also, I'd like to, in Malawi, be able to work with Mr. Chande and the clinic to have that as a great example of what people can do. We already have so much accomplished as far as what we've collected financially, plus all the other items for it. We're well on the way. It's possible to do. It's not costing most of us anything. It's just a matter of talking to people, collecting it, having the U.S. Army ship it, you know, have them do the work over there, which they are more than happy to do, and for which they are very, very thankful. Well, again, I could talk about this for a long time, but it was really a very productive trip in what we were able to see and accomplish and be able to do to help these people more.